This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara. This Tuesday, the Bilawila Tamil family set to be freed from immigration limbo now calls are growing for a wider examination of asylum seeker policy. And a controversial Victorian Liberal MP expelled from the party after calling for an abortion ban.
Expulsion of one extremist is not going to go nearly far enough to persuading voters that the party, the Liberal Party, has learned their lesson.
We begin today with politics, and Anthony Albanese is facing his first test on the world stage, with China's rising ambitions high on the agenda as the new Prime Minister is in Tokyo to meet with Joe Biden and the leaders of Japan and India. The countries form the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, or the Quad, a group aimed at curbing China's growing dominance in the Asia-Pacific. Mr. Albanese says the meeting of the Quad is an opportunity to tell the world that Australia has a new government with new priorities. Stephen Jedgetts is the ABC's foreign affairs reporter. Stephen, good afternoon. Why has Mr. Albanese made this trip, and what's at the heart of his message to the Quad group?
Well, there's a bit of signalling going along here, Sally. The main message is one of strategic reassurance, I think. Anthony Albanese is signalling to the Americans, the Japanese and the Indians that Australia's commitment to the Quad is undimmed, despite the fact there's been a change of government. I don't think there was a lot of reassurance needed. I think there's a realisation in all three countries that there's increasingly a lot of bipartisanship in Australia over these crucial questions of China, how to respond to it, the importance of groups like the Quad. But still, going there the day after being sworn in sends a very clear message from the new government that there's going to be more continuity than change when it comes to the Quad and China. But interestingly, in his opening address, Anthony Albanese was really keen to stress the importance of climate change, casting it really as an issue of national security and geopolitics, and arguing that Labor's plan to ramp up ambitions to make deeper cuts to carbon emissions in domestic policy would see its agenda align more neatly with that of the Quad. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
That's why my government will take ambitious action on climate change and increase our support to partners in the region as they work to address it, including with new finance. We will act in recognition that climate change is the main economic and security challenge for the island countries of the Pacific.
That's the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese there. And Stephen Jedgetts, what other topics are likely to dominate this Quad meeting?
Well, there'll be several. Ukraine will, of course, dominate again. And Joe Biden, in his opening remarks, once again stressed that the US saw that as a cataclysmic action which deserved a global response. Never an easy one in the Quad because of India's persistent links with Russia. That makes it difficult for them to reach a completely united front. But I think it'll crop up again. And then there'll probably be a number of other initiatives when it comes to COVID vaccines and also secure infrastructure, loans for the region and the like. Interestingly, one other key component that we might see is an initiative on illegal fishing. And that's a neat distillation of what the Quad is about, because whilst, at least publicly, it's all about protecting depleted fish stocks in the region, there's also a geopolitical overlay because Chinese fleets are responsible for the bulk of that overfishing.
And Stephen, meanwhile, China's foreign minister is due to visit the region this week. What do we know about that visit?
We think he's going to go to about five or perhaps even more countries. That will include Fiji, Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea, as well as Tonga. And we believe there might be one or two more. In Solomon Islands, I think there's a good chance he will sign, at least formally, that security agreement that's already been agreed to by both countries, causing great unease in Canberra. And then, of course, there's also going to be a series of other announcements, I imagine, unveiled in several other countries, including in Papua New Guinea. And this will be something that's monitored very closely in both Australia and America. There's great anxiety about the prospect of China signing more security pacts with other Pacific Island nations. So Wang Yi's visit across the Pacific is really a statement of intent, showing that China is intent on building up its diplomatic, commercial, but also potentially security links with the Pacific.
That's our foreign affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts there. The likely return of a Tamil asylum seeker family to the central Queensland town of Bilawila as early as next month has prompted calls for the new Labor government to start a broader and more radical overhaul of asylum seeker policy. The family has been fighting deportation to Sri Lanka, living in detention on Christmas Island, then in community detention in Perth. Immigration lawyers and analysts argue Labor's support to return the family to Bilawila and hopefully grant them permanent protection visas is a positive step. Stephanie Smale reports.
After a harrowing 4 years for the Nada Salingam's family, friend Simone Cameron says they're now feeling positive about what's ahead.
You can just see the stress has just melted off their faces and they're just so excited to plan for this more certain future now.
Simone Cameron says the family's mental health has suffered, but a return to their home in Bilawila, where they lived and worked before being removed in 2018, will help.
They've endured 3 deportation attempts by the LNP government, so they've never known any certainty at all in the last 4 years. And I would like to think that this chance at certainty and security will really help speed up the recovery.
During the campaign, Labor pledged to allow the Tamil family to stay in Australia, and senior Labor MPs have this week flagged the family's future as a priority. Simone Cameron says the sooner the better.
So we would really like to see the family brought home in time for the multicultural festival in Bilawila on the 11th of June and then Tanaka's 5th birthday is on the 12th of June.
Simone Cameron argues Saturday's election result is a strong signal that the new federal government has support in offering refugees a secure future in Australia.
For too long now, we've had debate that's just been stifled by fear and division.
Immigration analysts and lawyers argue temporary protection visas are just one part of a growing asylum seeker crisis. Former Immigration Department Deputy Secretary Abel Rizvi says huge numbers of refugees are living and working illegally in Australia.
So about 100,000 of them, twice the number who applied for asylum under Kevin Rudd, have under Peter Dutton applied for asylum. Vast bulk are being refused and they live in the community without work rights, without any support, constantly in fear.
Solicitor Michaela Byers has been lobbying the coalition for years to allow those asylum seekers to apply for bridging or other visas so they could access Medicare and work rights while they wait for court outcomes.
This group of people were really affected by the COVID pandemic. They had no work rights, so they couldn't claim any disaster relief payments or JobKeeper, and they had no access to Medicare, and a number of them were homeless. One had a horrific heart attack and ended up in hospital.
She says it's time for change, arguing the new Labor government has the opportunity to change the rules.
I believe that a new Minister for Immigration would agree to try and legalise these people that are in the community illegally. And I believe it's a crime to leave people illegally, deliberately, illegally in the community.
That's Solicitor Michaela Byers ending that report from Stephanie Smale. Well, we're just days into the new Albanese government and the issue of broader protection is back on the news agenda. Questions are being asked about a text which was sent to voters, pointing out that a boat full of asylum seekers had been intercepted on its way from Sri Lanka. The Liberal Party authorised the text message and was directed to voters in marginal electorates. Labor says the move was rank opportunism and is hinting it will investigate. Catherine Gregory reports.
Peter Dunn was one of scores of voters who received an unsolicited text from the coalition on Saturday afternoon, just before the polls closed.
Well, over the whole years of the asylum seeker saga, I've never ever received anything like that before. On the eve of the election, it was a clear scare campaign tactic.
The text said that Australian Border Force had intercepted an illegal boat trying to reach Australia and said to vote Liberal to keep our border secure. Peter Dunn says it was easy to see through it.
Made me wonder what desperate efforts are being made to try and scare electors into voting for stronger borders.
The text contained a link to show it was authorised by the Liberal Party. The ABC has received multiple copies of the messages from people who live in marginal electorates, such as Hughes, Macquarie, Dunkley and Gilmore. Peter Dunn, who's also the former commissioner for the ACT's Emergency Services Authority, voted in Gilmore.
Without going into the details of how I voted, obviously not for the coalition, it was just one of many of the scare tactics that were used that, frankly, now have been put to bed by the general Australian electorate as being unacceptable in our political scheme.
Do you think, though, that other people that received that text that afternoon might have been swayed to vote for the coalition?
Catherine, I know that there are people around here that stopped and really gave the text gave them pause for thought. They too were so surprised at getting a text like this. I'm talking of two people. They wondered whether they had been missing something in the whole of the campaign. There will be a number of people being swayed. Also, there are others that were actually steeled in their resolve not to accept that sort of rubbish from political advertising.
Gilmore is currently on a knife edge. Liberal candidate Andrew Constance looks like he might win the seat with just a few hundred votes ahead of the incumbent, Labor's Fiona Phillips. The World Today has approached Andrew Constance for comment about the text. Nine newspapers are reporting the Albanese government will investigate the detection of the boat and the timing of the public disclosure. Acting Prime Minister Richard Marles says the texts were a disgrace.
And it says everything about how the former Liberal government were all about the politics in advance of themselves and were not about the national interest. I mean, that text message made our borders weaker. That text message sent a terrible message to the region, and that text message had only one interest in mind, and that was the Liberals' political interest. We've made really clear that when it comes to border security, our borders remain strong.
There are questions about whether the coalition should have made the boat detection public. Jacinta Carroll is a defence and security analyst.
And usually any public commentary around boat arrivals and matters happening operationally at sea are reserved for ministers, or when senior officials make a comment, it's with the approval of ministers. So this raises some questions around what was happening during the caretaker period.
Dr. Carroll says Australia's had a fairly strong bipartisan policy approach to boat arrivals and people smuggling for some time.
Depending on which government's been in power. So, of course, when we had our original boat crisis, irregular maritime arrivals crisis, we had a Labor government. While the coalition came in for some years after, the kinds of quite strong mechanisms and building a dedicated role of border force, ensuring that we have the military involvement through Maritime Border Command is something that has been built up incrementally over the years.
But voter Peter Dunn says the text message was highly misleading and shows the need for better rules in political advertising.
This has raised a complete discussion now about truth in political advertising, how the parties presented themselves to the Australian community.
That's Gilmore voter Peter Dunn ending that report by Catherine Gregory, and the Liberal Party has been contacted for comment. On ABC Radio, right across the country, you're listening to The World Today. Controversial Victorian Liberal MP Bernie Finn has been expelled from the state's parliamentary party. Mr. Finn has advocated the banning of abortion in Victoria, even for survivors of rape. This morning, Victoria's opposition leader, Matthew Guy, said the move to expel Mr. Finn is about creating a respectful, sensible, alternative government. Oliver Gordon reports.
Controversial upper house MP Bernie Finn has never been one to mince his words. This morning, after being expelled from the Liberal Party, he didn't hold back.
What we have seen today is a statement from the leader of our party that the party that I joined over 40 years ago, over 41 years ago, is dead.
Just days after the Federal Liberal Party lost a swathe of blue ribbon seats in the party's traditional heartland, the Victorian Liberal Party has moved swiftly. In a meeting this morning, the party voted to send Bernie Finn to the crossbench for a series of inflammatory comments about abortion and the Victorian Premier, Daniel Andrews. Opposition leader Matthew Guy says the move should be seen as a step towards a more respectful Victorian Liberal Party.
It is now about the Liberal Party not navel-gazing from a federal election or other issues. It is about moving on and being a sensible alternative government. A respectful, sensible alternative government.
Earlier this month, Mr. Finn posted on Facebook he was praying for abortion to be banned in Victoria, including for rape victims. Previously, he's compared Premier Daniel Andrews with Hitler. Matthew Guy says the party has had enough.
I think you've seen enough examples over the last particularly few weeks, but also months before it, you know, referring to Hitler, for instance. I just think the debate needs to be respectful, and I think the repeated examples of this parliamentary party, not just me, party as a whole has had enough.
Opposition leader Matthew Guy says he's disappointed it has come to this.
In many ways, it is disappointing that it has come to this, but I expect discipline from all members of the parliamentary party, and I expect people to uphold respectful discourse. Whatever their issues may be, whatever their topics may be, needs to be respectful.
Today, Bernie Finn remains adamant he's done nothing wrong.
I have done nothing wrong.
Shame.
I have done nothing wrong. What do they do to somebody who does do something wrong? That's what I want to know. Can we expect a lynching on the steps here?
The stoush between Bernie Finn and the Victorian Liberal Party has the attention of political commentators. University of Melbourne political science professor Sarah Madison says the move within the Victorian branch of the party is significant, and it underlies other big ideological questions the party faces in the wake of its disastrous loss in the weekend's federal election.
The Liberal Party has been effectively decimated. It's going to take them a long time to come back from this loss, and they're certainly not going to come back from this loss with more of the same. They're going to need to show Australian voters that they have heard the lessons from this election and are going to change direction quite substantially.
And do you think this expulsion of Bernie Finn is going to send that message? Do you think it'll land with voters?
I think that message will be lost if Peter Dutton is elected leader nationally of the Federal Liberal Party. You know, voters are angry. They made that very clear on Saturday night. The expulsion of one extremist is not going to go nearly far enough to persuading voters that the Liberal Party, has learned their lesson. So, yes, possibly a step in the right direction. That will be confirmed or denied when we see who the next leader of the Federal Party is and what direction they choose to take the party in next. So I guess I'm wary of reading too much into this one decision at state level. I think there are much bigger national issues at play.
That's University of Melbourne Professor of Political Science Sarah Madison, ending that report from Oliver Gordon. Well, as the dust settles on Saturday's federal election, it's not just politicians trying to make sense of the shift away from the major parties and the rise of female independent candidates. How will the 2022 election go down in history, and have we been here before? Claire Wright is Professor of History at La Trobe University and is author of You Daughters of Freedom, The Australians Who Won the Vote and Inspired the World.
Well, I think what's so magnificent about it, Sally, is that it's reflective of an historical trend that we haven't really discussed much. So Australia was the first country in the world where women could stand for parliament. That happened in 1903, and we should specify that is white women we're talking about. And that's because the passage of the Franchise Act gave women these world-leading historic rights. And the first time that somebody was able to stand for parliament, in the first election that was viable, was 1903. And indeed, Vida Goldstein, who was the leading suffrage campaigner in Australia, internationally recognised figure, was the first woman to stand for parliament. And she ran as an independent. And she ran as an independent because she was very against party politics. She felt that it ran against the interests of women and children and the home, and that larger issues would subsume that agenda, that men wouldn't listen to the needs of women within their party, and therefore she ran as an independent. And many of these early suffrage campaigners were similarly independent. So in some ways we've been here before, and we could have seen this coming, and we should have seen it coming from the time that Cathy McGowan was elected for the Voices of Indi, because the way in which she campaigned, the style of campaigning that she inaugurated, was very much reflective of the way that suffrage campaigners and that first wave of feminism did its politics.
It's interesting too, looking at some of these important milestones. So compulsory voting, that actually didn't come in until 1924, but some of the history is saying that the number of women voters was very high. Women voters may have been the majority in some of those early days after they got the vote.
That's right. So if we're not looking just at as women as candidates, but women as voters, we also could have seen that women have had a very strong influence in politics. The 1910 election, which was the first election to put a Labor government in Parliament in the world, an elected Labor government, first in the world, that vote, that outcome was largely put down to not only the vote of women, who vastly outnumbered men at the ballot box that year, but also the campaigning and organising strength and capacities of women, that women were the ones who were going around enrolling other women to vote. So there was precedent for all of these things. And you know, we've heard so much about the fact that the Liberal Party didn't listen to women and what they were saying over the last at least decade, but they also haven't been listening to history.
There seems to be time and again a lag between a change in legislation and a change in practice. There's been a lag. When do you think we will finally get a fully representative parliament, when we're not just looking at gender but also people of colour who were excluded for quite a period of time, people with disabilities, people from different backgrounds? When do you think we'll start to catch up?
Well, I do think that this election is going to be a game changer in that regard, because, of course, it's not only the Teal independents that have made inroads and means that there is going to be a much larger representation of women in Parliament. There are Labor members as well who have taken seats off sitting Liberals, and many of them are women of colour. We are starting to get a much more diverse range of people and voices in our Parliament, and I think that they're going to have to catch up, and they will put more faith in the public to choose the people who they best feel represent their interests.
That's Claire Wright, Professor of History at La Trobe University and author of You Daughters of Freedom, The Australians Who Won the Vote and Inspired the World, looking at federal elections of days gone by. Well, Australia's first Indigenous Employment Index shows racism is common in the workplace for First Nations people. The survey of 42 major employers conducted by Andrew Forrest Mindaroo Foundation says many Indigenous employees feel culturally unsafe at work, where they often face discrimination or ridicule. Our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan, has been reading the report. We spoke a short time ago.
Well, good afternoon, Sally. Some big names: the Commonwealth Bank, the ANZ, Australia Post, the NBN Co, Ampol, Atlassian, to name a few of the 42 surveyed. Companies that you'd think would already have strong Indigenous employment policies sitting on the shelf, but they're clearly not enough. Among a range of findings, the report says employers are failing to retain Indigenous staff compared to non-Indigenous employees. Indigenous representations at senior leadership levels is almost non-existent, and there's a long way to go before there's parity between Indigenous and non-Indigenous employees. I spoke with Shelley Cable, who's chief executive of the Mindaroo Foundation's Generation One initiative, and she told me racism in the workplace is shattering the potential of Indigenous Australians.
Yeah, look, it's quite an unfortunate finding, and we know that racism is very, you know, alive and well in Australian society. Many people would be familiar and know about the overt, direct, you know, person-to-person racism. Racism can be indirect, it can be unconscious, it can be, you know, it can often be well-intentioned as well, but employers really need to increase their understanding of what racism is and the many different forms that it can take.
That indirect racism and the subconscious or the unconscious racism, what does that entail, and how damaging is it to the morale of Indigenous workers in reaching their potential?
Racism experienced not in the workplace, but perhaps by customers or clients or people who are outside of that particular organisation. We also talk about systemic racism, which is things that are often written well-intentioned into policies and practices that are thought for every worker, for all Australians, but actually have a disproportionately negative impact on Indigenous Australians. And often that's a little bit harder to spot because it's not intentional, but it does have the impact of often excluding Indigenous Australians from today's workforces.
But have you been forced to create this index simply because Indigenous employment is much lower profile than it should be?
I think you could say that, Peter. I really do. I think, you know, when we know how many Indigenous Australians are incarcerated on a given night, but we have to wait 5 years for the census to figure out how many Indigenous Australians are in work, there's clearly a gap here that needs to be filled, and this index is going part of the way to filling that.
That's Shelley Cable, the Chief Executive of Mindaroo Foundation's Generation One. She was speaking to our Senior Business Correspondent, Peter Ryan. That's all from the World Today team for this Tuesday. Thanks for your company. We'll be back again at the same time tomorrow. I'm Sally Sarah. Stay safe.
Hey, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Voters in seats held by the Liberals since the 1900s have rejected Scott Morrison and the coalition in droves, instead turning to independents with platforms on climate change and integrity in government. Today, the ABC's Fran Kelly on how Scott Morrison stopped listening to his party's heartland, the painful period ahead for the election losers. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.